Hey, before we get into this week's episode, I did just want to take a moment to share a couple of shout outs. This episode was recorded before the outcome of the latest award. I think it was the Emmys or something like that. And anyway, shout out to Abbott Elementary and star Quinta Brunson, who wrote and co-starred, well, she created and stars in the show, for the show winning, I think it was Best New Comedy or something like that. I can't remember, but it won. And writing, Best Writing on a Series or something like that. And then to Cheryl Lee Ralph, veteran actress and just wonderful singer, talented woman, for winning, earning an Emmy for her work on the show, because she's great on that show. Love her. Anyway, very excited. But again, recorded the show before the outcome of the awards, and I wanted to add that little note. Okay, now to today's show. I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. This episode, I told y'all last week that I watched P-Valley, and I binged every single episode from season one all the way to season two, and I'm gonna try to my level best to keep this thing under 2 hours, because I could talk so long about this. And I think, so anyway, I'm going to talk all about P-Valley. First, I will give a little update. The water crisis in District 9 here in Baltimore, all those who lived in District 9 is over, according to DPW. From what I remember from what I saw on Twitter, again, yet I was notified of the water issue on Twitter, and it's only right that I saw another tweet saying that it's over. But they said if it feels right, just run the water for a couple of seconds, just to make sure that it's clear and everything is cool. But if you feel so inclined, you're still welcome to boil your water, but you don't have to. And I maintain that while I don't live in District 9, you know, thanks to gerrymandering, parts of District 9, or at least maybe a block of District 9, kind of, or at least two blocks actually, kind of snake down into my district. And those blocks, which are not in the catchment area, mind you, the catchment or the impact area, the highest impact area, Sandtown, Winchester, certainly a neighborhood that definitely didn't need a water crisis on top of all the other things that it's been dealing with. You know, Sandtown, Winchester, if you're not from the metro Baltimore area, if you're not even from Maryland, if you're not even from the United States, you don't even live on the East Coast, you're not even from the United States, you've heard of Sandtown, Winchester before, because that is exactly where Freddie Gray, the Freddie Gray incident happened, and that's where a lot of protests happened here in Baltimore. That's where a lot of the damage, the ruckus that went down in the Sandtown Winchester area in response to what happened to Freddie Gray. Anyway, and so that's precisely in the heart of District 9. And so anyway, I'm not close to that. I could walk to Sandtown Winchester, but it would take me regular walking speed way too long. It's better to get there by bus or by car or whatever. But anyway, that was the emphasis area where you definitely needed that. That's where they actually found the traces of E. coli and all of that in the water source. But they said that everybody in District 9 should test, and District 9 went all the way out into the county, in Laurelville, Arbutus, and Catonsville. But I just found it, interesting, to say that just folks in District 9 needed to, pay attention to the water and boil their water, because again, thanks to gerrymandering, District 9, while that's not my district, it's the adjacent district to mine. And while I'm sort of kind of smack dab in the middle. I'm in the theater district, and one of the major streets that's in the theater district, District 9, again, thanks to gerrymandering, District 9 is maybe 10 blocks away, depending on which way you go. Like if you're going through that one major street. So I'm just, I probably should have been boiling my water, although I didn't get sick, neither did my hubby. My homegirl, her mama, who lives in my district, her mama lives in my district, which is way up on the other side of it. I'm more downtown, she's more uptown. Actually, she's way uptown and I'm way downtown from her. She boiled her water, and actually she's smart. I probably should have been boiling my water too, just in case, because it don't hardly make sense. You know what I mean? Like it's literally just, it feels like it was literally just isolated to the Sandtown Winchester area, but they said everybody in District 9 is on a boil water alert just to be safe, but it was probably just District 9 or just the Sandtown Winchester neighborhood. Anyway, but that's over. So, but unfortunately it's not in Jackson. So we'll keep an eye on that. Continue to send your support there. Hopefully the link that I shared or the info that I shared was helpful to you. Again, as far as I know, those were reputable. So if you wonder what I'm talking about, again, the water crisis in Jackson necessitates people, neighbors, people who have means to go and help out, because unfortunately and pitifully, the city services in Mississippi, just Jackson itself, which is the capital, girl, and plus the state, just can't seem to get it together. And so there are benevolent organizations that already serve in Jackson, which is the key thing here. Not the ones that have converged onto Jackson, but the ones who are already doing the work, had been doing work to support the community, were providing resources. And I tried to vet the sources as best I could, and I gave you what I think was reputable. So hopefully that worked out for you. And if you're interested in donating to those causes to get water, or to those charities to get water, just go back to my last episode. It's in the show notes. Anyway, but let me hasten on and talk to you about Katori Hall's P-Valley. The Starz show, which premiered in 2020, is based on Katori Hall, the actor, director, producer, writer, extraordinaire, Katori Hall, her play that actually spells out what the P in P-Valley stands for. And long story short, it's called P-Valley because it is, for all intents and purposes, it is a story that revolves around people who work or engage with or impacted by an exotic dancing club called The Pink. And it's spelled P-Y-N-K, and it's often pronounced The Pank. You know, because the accent and AAVE and Black people. But anyway, so for all intents and purposes, this club is the center of a lot of folks' universe. And certainly it becomes the center of the universe for many of the characters. And it also is a jumping point for a lot of the storylines that kind of take flight in the show. This show, it has at least five or six heavy, intense storylines. In this show, that is, the premise is these people work or impacted in some way by a strip club in the middle of nowhere in Mississippi, a poor town in Mississippi, right? But with this story, with this show, the storylines you get run from a broken mother-daughter relationship and the daughter trying to not mend or build a relationship with her mother. But I don't know why I'm yawning. I've had plenty of rest. I did not even have a long day. Anyway, it's a dysfunctional mother and daughter, actually two mother-daughter mother-daughter relationships. It's like an intergenerational. How about that? It's an intergenerational mother-daughter relationship conversation. And does it get after school specially at times? Sure. But it's an interesting conversation that is happening. cycles. There's a lot of cycles repeating themselves, breaking generational curses. That's a common theme in this show. Another common theme is, unfortunately, abuse and fleeing abuse. And the reasons why we stay sometimes, and those reasons aren't because we're weak. And I don't think we can say that enough. When a person is engaged in a violent relationship, an intimate partner violent relationship, it doesn't happen all at once. And I know that people who are a part of safety organizations spend a lot of time talking to young people and people my age and people older, trying to dispel that myth that these people knew what they were getting into when they engaged with this person. They showed their true colors. They've been showed their true colors. This show just reminds us, first off, let's just take into account, it makes us look at our own relationships. And not that we're comparing them, but think about it. When you were courting, if you are married or if you were in a long-term relationship, when you were courting your significant other, how long did it take before you were who you are today? Like, how long did it take for you to show vulnerability? Let's be for real. When people are going on first dates, even when people decide to couple together, first couple of months, you still seeing their representative. You're not seeing who they are, because even though you've agreed that you want to be with this person and this person wants to be with you, you're still not totally yourself. Now, put on top of this, one of the people is an abuser. There's a huge conversation about dispelling the myth of why people get into domestic partner violent situations. And it's a slow burn oftentimes, and it's a pattern. And they even talk about the pattern in a couple of the episodes. They talk about it a couple of times, but one episode, the lead character, Uncle Clifford, really breaks it down. And so that's a conversation. It is not the whole of the show, but it is a big part of the show, because we engage in the conversation and with at least two of the principal characters, in one way or the next. It's a storyline for one, but it is a part of the conversation in another. We also deal with broken families. There's a whole storyline of a child that grew up their entire life not being accepted, knowing who their father was, but not being accepted until the father died and was announced in the will. And how must that be like to live in a town where you know who your father is, but you are not, you see, oh, and here's the other thing. Not only do you know who your father is and you're not acknowledged, but your father has, you have siblings and your father is well off and the siblings are afforded everything that they could ever want at their fingertips. And you and your mother live in squalor. A story old as time. It's not an original story, but the way that this manifests is interesting, to say the very least, because through this, there's a pivotal piece of that particular storyline that kind of drives the narrative of the show. So there's that piece. Also, race and culture is a part of it too. And the ugly past that is what this nation, the United States, was built on, which was the backs of human capital. And all the different ways that it tried to benefit from human capital, from the, indigenous American, to the Asian American in one way or the next. There's always a conversation about how the United States, and it's not even a self-righteous conversation. It's just a matter of fact sort of thing, because let's be for real, that is the story of us. The story of us in part is how the country was formed, which was on human capital. The rich have always used the poor and have always tried to benefit from their labor, blood, sweat, and tears, their very bodies, always. and continues to in this day. It's just it was more blatant back then. But anyway, so there's a conversation about that. There's a conversation about love. There's several conversations about love. One of them is very unique because there is an there is a non-traditional relationship, I'll say that, in that there is a character by the name of Uncle Clifford who identifies as she, her, but some in the town who are closed-minded view as a flamboyant male. And there's a conversation there because it's, and again, the thing that I love about this show is that the hard conversation that it engages you in, they don't beat you over the head with it. They present the information and have the characters engage in a dialogue around it and then keep it pushing. It is not the totality of a single episode. It's not even the whole of the series. It is a part of the series in as much as all of the other stories are a part of the series that, again, genuinely make up this community that is Tuscaloosa, this fictional community that is called Tuscaloosa, Mississippi. So there's that relationship between, I don't know that Uncle Clifford considers themselves to be trans, but they definitely identify as, they use she, her pronouns. So I guess I'm just going to call her a trans character until I know more, but that's how I see Uncle Clifford. Uncle Clifford. Yeah, that's how I see Uncle Clifford. And so Uncle Clifford is the queen of the pink, rules over the pink, and is a mother to some, a confidant to others, a best friend to others, still others, and a sibling to some as well. And then the grandson of a woman who is her grandmother, who passed on the club to Clifford. There is a reason why we have in the show, we only see the interactions and we only see Uncle Clifford engaging with his grandmother. There's a reason for that. That represents, oh my goodness. And I didn't even think of it until this point, but Uncle Clifford's relationship with his grandmother and the fact that it's the two of them, is indicative of an entire generation lost to drug use in the 80s. That is why Uncle Clifford is in this show. When we meet Uncle Clifford, Uncle Clifford is like 39. And in the second season, Uncle Clifford turns 40. So Uncle Clifford is around my age. And we are the product of a generation of parents who went missing for a number of different reasons. And to be honest, yeah, a whole generation. And that's part of the millennial experience, that it's a part of the X experience, but because it was going on for so long, it's also a part of the millennial experience, which is why many of us, depending on how you were raised in the United States, certainly, but then across the globe, drugs became a huge problem globally. And so there's a piece of that, especially if you were of color and you were not affluent, there's a part of that missing generation of people that impacts you. And even, because here's the deal, even if you don't know anybody readily who, like in your immediate family, that was lost to drug use, you know plenty of, you grew up knowing what coke was. You grew up knowing what certain illicit drugs were, and when someone, you also understood when someone was gone off of a drug. You knew it. You understood it. You might not have seen it in person, and thank God if that was your case, but you definitely saw it on TV. We were the generation, I don't know that we were the first generation to see it, but I'm talking about like prime time TV. Our generation saw it in movies, saw it in shows. As a cautionary tale, mind you, our generation was the one that had tons of all the PSAs and the DARE program. Our generation started, were the first folks to get into the DARE program. And so we're among the vanguard. I'll say that we were among the vanguard. And anyway, so there's a conversation about that multi-generation, that missing generation, that's there. There's also a conversation about aging. Actually, there's a big conversation about aging, but done different ways. Aging in the exotic dancing community, and literally just aging as a person and legacy. And a big conversation about legacy. Huge. Many people in this show talk about legacy a lot. That's a great conversation that's had. There's another conversation about, in the same vein of escaping intimate partner violence, what starts out as escaping intimate partner violence is really, there's several conversations about rebirth. Several. There's one character, her name is Haley. She goes, her dancing name is something else, but from episode 1 all the way to the final episode, I believe is episode 10 of season 2, Haley takes you through changes, takes you through what it truly means to change your life, but not in one of those motivational speaker ways. That literally, I want to be another person. I want to have a totally different identity and the sacrifice that requires. Also kind of looks you in the face and you have a conversation about what you'll do to survive and what that might mean to the people around you, which that's a hard conversation. There's a political conversation as well. I don't think you can have any sort of show worth its weight in gold anymore. Worth its salt, that does not include a political conversation, especially when you're talking about in the South and you're talking about Black people, predominantly Black show. I don't think you can escape politics, especially the nature of this show, because big business is a part of this and upward mobility is a part of this too. Again, all themes that I don't know that you can have a show like this and not talk about it. But so I've talked about so many themes already. You see that I've already talked about so many themes. And so I think two things that made me want to watch this show, and one thing that made me want to binge it. So I'll start with the two things that made me want to watch it. I was listening to, even though I had seen for the past 2 years, I had heard people talking about P-Valley. I had seen some of the trailers, or at least snippets of some of the episodes, like a little bitty snippets. Began to spend a lot of time on TikTok, you know, over the past weeks or so, I guess when the show ended, season two ended, that people were making memes on TikTok about how the dancers in the pink, how they actually dance, and you know, everybody's gyrating, being real aggressive with the clicking of their heels. But that didn't move me to go watch it. I don't have Stars naturally. For whatever reason, my expensive cable package does not carry the Stars channel. You have to ask for it, which I think is wild. But moving on. I hadn't been moved to talk about it or to watch it until I listened to an episode maybe 2 weeks ago from Marsha's Plate, which is, I've talked about Marsha's Plate before, but it is a trans, it's a podcast about all things trans, not everything trans, but trans people lead the show. There are three trans hosts on the show. And of course they highlight and elevate trans issues, but then they just generally talk about Black life, because all three hosts identify as being a part of the Black diaspora. And that's just a part of their story. And I think, but they elevate trans issues because they're one of a kind. I don't know any other Black trans-led show that exists. First off, I don't know that another one exists. You might have trans representation in your podcast, but I've never known. I don't know of another one that exists where it's trans-led. They're probably trans-led podcasts, but they're not Black trans-led podcast, which makes a difference. And so it's just the conversations that you have are just a little bit different. But at the same time, because they're a part of the diaspora, I find so many ways to relate to what they're talking about, even though they're not all the time talking about my segment of the community. Women's issues, women with an X, women period, half the time. I understand that there are certain moments where it's a distinction, but when it comes to love relationships, in many ways, there's not much difference. But I understand that there needs to be a difference because it is a different lived experience that a trans woman will go through things that I will never go through. And that's just a simple, that's a cold hard fact. There's a biological thing that a trans woman at the moment will never be able to go through that I will go through. And that's a fact. But nevertheless, and so we have to respect those differences. But at the same time, there's just so many things that are the same about some of the stories that they go through, or at the very least in the ways that they feel marginalized. Again, respecting the difference and respecting the threat that some people see them as, that is different than the way that someone would perceive a cis-hetero, straight, I said the same thing twice, cis-hetero Black woman, but still respecting the differences, but also there's just so much there that you can vibe with and that you can relate to. I just wish everybody would listen to it. I just wish everybody would listen to it because they do a really good job of talking about Black life and Black trans life specifically across the country. And there have been times where they hit on Baltimore because there was some stuff happening in Baltimore. There is a bomb. Baltimore Safe Haven is one of the most outstanding. I think it's the leading, if not the, I don't think it's the only, but it's definitely the leading Black trans led organization that doesn't just support Black trans or trans people, but has a place for trans identifying people to support and find a home and find other resources. And they do really great work, and they're led by a person that is just outstanding and has been doing the work since the Freddie Gray incident that I mentioned earlier. And what is that, 2015? Been doing the work, was on Time magazine in that protest cover, but you never even knew it. Didn't get recognition, of course, but they're getting their flowers now. So let's just, you know, they're getting their flowers now. In that, not that they're getting themselves getting the recognition, but the work is getting the recognition, which at the end of the day, I think that's what she wants. So I know that's what she wants. And anyway, so long story short, so I listened to Marsha's Plate Elevated their work, Baltimore Safe Haven's work here. Google Baltimore Safe Haven. You should donate money to them. They're a really great organization. But anyway, but yeah, so... So I've been listening to Marsha's Play for years at this point. And besides the fact, Diamond, which is the lead person there, she tells really great stories. I'm talking about, boy, she is a wonderful storyteller, and I do love me a good story. Anyway, so she was leading a conversation with some of, not the co-leaders of the show, but some other guests that were just talking about P-Valley. And the thing that hooked me was their conversation about the relationship between, and I think I didn't even finish this, but Uncle Clifford, who again identifies, I view as a trans woman, has with this guy that presents as a cis hetero male, but throughout the series, discovers, but begins to be more open about his queerness. And that's Lil Murda. Lil Murda and Uncle Clifford have, you, I guess you could call it a relationship. It's more like a physical relationship in the very beginning that evolves into something more. And then something very interesting happens in the last two episodes. There's a shift that happens and there's a real conversation that's had there, and something that's pretty kind of refreshing happens, but I'll get to that. We'll see. I'll make a point to talk about it if even if I can't talk about it at length, because there's so much. I'm trying to cover two seasons in this episode. So because it's just, I mean, I think I'm going to stick to the themes because I can't talk about it episode by episode. It's too much. But yeah, so they spent the entire episode, I think, other than talking about some of the characters that were awesome or some of the characters that were so good, that the actors were so good as these characters, you hated them. Talk about you, Haley. What is her name? Alarica? Alarica something. I'll go through in the next segment, I'll go through who plays who, but Haley Colton is played by an actress named Alarica something. I can't remember her last name, but anyway, I went from loving her character because she introduces us to Chuckalusa. We are introduced to Chuckalusa through Haley, and we're introduced to the pink through Haley. And it's an interesting way how she sees the pink, how she's drawn to the pink, but I'll get to that. But anyway, boy, you start off really rooting for Haley. That's the one that we're talking about, the transformation. And at what cost are you transforming? Like, who are you hurting in the process? And what that might mean, like, are you ready for those consequences? So we go from, and I'm going to do a little bit of foreshadowing, but we go from rooting for her, or at least certainly I went from rooting for Haley to rooting against Haley at the end. Rooting for Haley at the beginning of season one to rooting against her at the end, by the end of season two. And your loyalties shift a little bit. And I think that's a good thing. And it asks you some very interesting questions because, again, Haley, there was a reason. There's good reason why you root for Haley in the beginning. Very good reason. You come to learn at the end of the first season that not everything is as it seems, but that doesn't change the fact that you should be rooting for Haley in the beginning. Is there another thing that I want to talk about? No. I think that's it. I think so. There's a lot to be. So the reason why I watched the show in the first place is because Marcia's Plates talked so highly about this fully realized conversation about trans women, transness, and cis hetero presenting Black men who are actually queer, and they're wrapping their brain around what attraction means, and attraction to someone that is considered to be taboo, and what that really means. Because let's be clear, not just in the Black community, in every community, trans people are not safe. Trans people are not as protected as they should be. But I'm going to live in the Black community for a second. In the Black community, in the Black African American, in the Black community in the United States, Black trans women are at, I don't know that I can say that they're more at risk than Black women. I would say that I don't even want to compare. What I'm saying is they're highly at risk. And what we've seen before the pandemic, what we saw was a large number of Black trans women losing their lives at the hands of intimate partners. And these partners would say, oh, well, they tricked me. But it would come out. The police would come out that they had been talking, and that the woman had told the guy her story, and it only turned violent when his friends found out. Yep. Now, that is not to say, so, and again, that's not to say that violence against women, specifically violence against Black women, is not ridiculous and heartbreaking, and we all know the stories. We've seen the videos of women. We across the globe, trans women need to be protected. Trans people need to be protected, but specifically trans women in this context need to be protected. And in the United States, trans women of color, specifically Black women, trans women need to be protected, because half of the time, the reason why they face physical violence is because of who they are. Literally, they didn't do anything to deserve it except be who they are. And then their partner knew, and it's only when they got exposed because they were doing their dirt in the dark. Not their dirt, but they were doing the, you know, they were engaging in this relationship that they really wanted to be in the dark. And then when their friends found out, they were not able to come to terms with it. And so the way that they solved their problem was to take it out on the person that they were in love with, which again is the root of violence against women in many ways. It's, I don't like my situation. I want to control something, so let me control you. But this just feels different because literally it's not even about control. It's about embarrassment. Or maybe it is about control, like who knows what. But still, anyway, so because they talked about the story and it told, I don't like to see trauma just for trauma's sake. And so when they were talking about Marcia's Plate, when Diamond and her guests were talking about P-Valley and how that was a trauma-free relationship, or even in the tussling going back and forth, of Uncle Clifford accepting, rejecting, and even Lil Murda accepting and rejecting the relationship. Both of them went back and forth doing that. There wasn't trauma there, and I appreciate that because I didn't want to see that. That said, there's a lot of violence in P-Valley. Of course, there's a lot of explicitly intimate scenes in P-Valley. There's also an element of Afro-spiritualism in P-Valley, which I don't know that I was expecting, but I think you can't have a story set in Mississippi and not talk about spiritualism. So specifically voodoo and hoodoo, which some say as a colonized word. I go back and forth. I don't know that hoodoo is, I don't know. I think it's an etymological, anyway, I don't want to go down that road. But anyway, I think that hoodoo, H-O-O-D-O-O, is, I forgot the term of it, but it is a nod to H-U-D-U. That is a form of Afro-spiritualism, or it's an aspect of Afro-spiritualism in voodoo practiced in on the continent. Which anyway, but why am I even talking about that? Long story short, there's a portion of Afro-spiritualism in here. And so I feel like the show has just about everything for everybody, as long as you are of age to watch it. So anyway, in the next segment, so that's the reason why I watched it. I watched it for P-Valley, and then I watched it because Marcia's Plate gave it such a great review, and the fact that there were so many Black stars in it, including Loretta Devine, and that it was an interesting story set in the South, but it wasn't like a typical story, even though the story itself is kind of generic. The how we get there in the story is pretty great. But then the reason why I stayed is because I watched episode one and I was hooked. I could not watch the rest of them. So in the next segment, now that I've gone through and given you that long old preamble or that explainer, I'm going to go through and talk about the highlights of the theme. I'm going to talk about the themes that are outlined in the both seasons. And that's probably how the only way that I'm going to be able to get through the seasons, because there's a whole lot to talk about. But anyway, next segment, I'm going to go through the particulars first, let you know who's in the show as best I can, and then talk about the major themes. So spoiler alert, if you haven't watched the show already, you should probably watch it. If you don't care, come on back. All right, stay tuned. Okay, before I continue, I do want to note something very historic that happened over the last week. And by the time this episode is released, Queen Elizabeth II passed last week. And at the moment of her passing, her son, Charles, immediately became King Charles. And there's lots of pop and circumstance and fanfare. There's also lots of conversations about her rule and what happened during her rule, and
colonization, racism, classism. There are really great conversations happening around this, while also following, there's a lot of discourse about following the pomp and circumstances, what's supposed to happen, who's doing what. People talking about Mary and Harry, Meghan and Harry again, division between the two brothers. Y'all can have that conversation. The United States divested from the UK, or the United Kingdom in 1776, and the United States has its own issues that it needs to, its own crosses that it needs to bear and come to terms with. So I will acknowledge this historic moment, and I'll leave it to the folks in the UK to determine what this truly does mean and what the future may bring, because there are certainly still countries that are products of colonization that are still connected to the UK. And so, you know, I'll leave all of those folks to talk about what all this means. But I'm just going to be over here perusing the news, watching clips, and keeping it moving. Okay. All right. So now we're moving on to talking about the major themes in P-Valley seasons 1 and 2. Okay. So I know I just ran them through in the intro. I'm not going to go in order. I'm going to go based on feeling. But before I get to that, I do want to again acknowledge Katori Hall as the executive producer, creator of the show, and the creator of the play for which the show is built on, based on. This show premiered July 2nd, the very first episode, the pilot episode of the first season, premiered July 12th, 2020, I believe on Stars. It was always on Stars. And so it has won NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Guest. To date, it has not received any other awards, but, you know, there's a school of thought, and I'm often in this camp, that awards don't mean as much to the viewer as they do to the actors, the producers, and everybody who works on the project. Because what we know is that awards, if you are a big time award winner, the more awards you get and the bigger the more prestigious the awards are, the more you can garner when it comes to contract time. And I understand that. But in terms of determining what is good and what is not, that's in the hands of the critics and the public. And what I know to be true is that a lot of people, not just Black folks, but a lot of people are talking about P-Valley and how good it is. Though it is featuring and very much centers around a predominantly Black community, and a particular aspect of the predominantly Black community in this southern state, in a poor town in a southern state, in the United States, it nevertheless still has a broad reach and a lot of people are engaged with it. So let that kind of fuel your thoughts regarding awards that this show has garnered to this point. It stars Brandi Evans as Mercedes, which is one of the, remember I was telling you, there's a intergenerational mother-daughter conversation being had. Well, Mercedes is the first daughter in that intergenerational conversation, and she's played by Brandi Evans. Nico Anon plays Uncle Clifford. Again, I would dare say that while we were introduced to Haley Colton, who's played by Alarica Johnson, and you kind of think that she's the primary character, I venture to guess not even guess, I will say from my perspective that Clifford, Uncle Clifford, is like the center of the universe of this show kind of revolves around. It definitely revolves around the pink. And because it revolves around the pink, it by default revolves around Uncle Clifford. Chill, bless me. Anyway, so... Oh my goodness, my sinuses. Oh my goodness, oh my goodness. I don't know if y'all are suffering the way I'm suffering, but my baby, between the sinus headaches and just my sinuses have been going through. And of course, I'm sneezing now, so, and stuffiness, but I'm gonna persevere. Anyway, Nico Anon plays Uncle Clifford. And yeah, so. Really great work. Actually, I've talked about the three main stars that I guess people like to talk about, but you cannot ignore the fact that J. Alphonse Nicholson, I was about to say Nicholson, Nicholson, that would be fine if you know, what's your last name? J. Alphonse Nicholson, and but it looks like it's spelled and should be pronounced Nicholson. It's probably Nicholson. Anyway, you can't ignore his interpretation of Little Murder. And that conversation. And then Keyshawn, which I will talk about. I will talk about her story. Keyshawn is played by Shannon Janiah Thornton. Loretta Devine plays Uncle Clifford's grandmother, but what is her character's name? Ernestine. Patricia Woodbine, which is Mercedes Woodbine's mother, is played by Harriet D. Foy, which I'm sure I've seen her in shows before. I am sure I've seen her in shows, but outside of this, but here we are. So anyway, so Patrice Woodbine, so the mother to Mercedes is Patrice, who's played by Harriet D. Foy. Who else did I want to tell you about? I don't know the daughter. Of course she wouldn't be listed here, because why would you on Google list things appropriately? Why would you do that? You would have no reason to do that. Deck on it. Hold on. It's not Shell. What's old girl's name? Oh, this is dumb. Anyway, this is so sad. She is literally a big part of the show. And again, a part of the triad. I'll just say Mercedes' daughter because I cannot remember her name. Anyway. Oh, here it goes. Azaria Carter plays Terica. Terica. All right. So, you know what? I think I'm going to start with the mother-daughter. The mother-daughter multi-generational conversation. And then I'll just kind of move. Really quickly, because here's the other thing. I meant to say this. Another thing that I had heard about P-Valley ad nauseum, but still wasn't moved to watch it, was the fact that there was a character named Diamond that was played by Tyler Lepley. And when I tell you, everybody was salivating when they were talking about the character Diamond. Even in Marsha's Plate, when they were talking about the episode a couple weeks ago, they drooled over Diamond. And having binged season one and season two, I understand why. He, not only is he fine, I mean, so that, let's just get that one out the way, he's fine. But then also, he emotional, okay? He is in tune with his emotions. And, you know, he tall. Well, is he tall? I don't know that he's tall. I won't give him all of that. But, yeah, he doesn't look like he's a veteran and he's just trying to overcome the traumas that he's seen in the I don't know that Katori meant to do this, but his storyline is that Diamond is a combat veteran who is a bouncer at this club in this country old poor town, right? Everybody's just kind of here. Again, the pink is the center of this universe. Anyway, so he's got a job and he's like family. He is another one of the, and I missed him completely. He is one of the other cis hetero presenting, and for all intents and purposes, he is in this show, cis hetero male that accepts Uncle Clifford. And I think I like seeing that. So I think everybody was fawning over him because he didn't appear to be problematic. He in multiple fronts, right? So he didn't appear to be homophobic and he didn't appear to be sexist, because there were certainly, I wouldn't call him a feminist, but there are certainly situations where he's like, I'm just going to be here in case you need some muscle. I know I'm the muscle and I'm fine with being the muscle, but I'm also appreciate that I'm a part of family and I'm going to do whatever I need to do to protect family. And because of that, also there's a storyline in here since we talking, there's a storyline in here where, what's old girl's name? Keyshawn. So Deshawn is like a lovesick puppy after Keyshawn, but Keyshawn is married to a trifling man named Derek who comes from money but doesn't have any money and is abusive to Keyshawn. And so Diamond, I mean, within the first couple of episodes of season one, Diamond offers to end Derek's existence. And so I understand why everybody was just drooling over him, because he is an attractive thing to look at. And then you start paying attention to his storyline and then it's like, okay, Katori, okay. Like, pile on the more of the, whatever. Anyway, I get it. I don't want to get it, but I get it. Anyway, and I can't help it. He's cute. But anyway, so that storyline, let me keep going before I dig right into it. So anyway, so Tyler Lepley is fine behind. Yeah, that's all I want to talk about. Isaiah Washington is in this thing, which surprises me because, to be honest with you, I didn't, again, when I was looking this thing up, I went in cold and I just watched it. I didn't know who was playing who. And I don't even remember the buzz. I remember people talking about the show, but I don't remember the buzz around everybody who was like the actors, except for Tyler Lepley. That is the only actor's name I knew without question was daggone Tyler Lepley. Anyway, outside of that, I didn't know who was playing anybody. And so when I started to watch season one, and then I saw that there was a face in there that struck me. And I was like, I know this face, but I can't place him. I know this face, but I can't place him. Come to find out at the end, I think I watch a credit. Because you know how when you binge something, you don't go to the credits. You just cut, you trim the fat. You trim the intro and you trim the credits and you move on to the next episode. So I think I intentionally stopped one of the episodes to see who was in the credits and saw that it was doggone head Isaiah Washington, which again, the way he left, I don't remember much about him. I don't remember anything about his career after he left Grey's Anatomy the way that he did. And he got booted off the show, and rightly so, because Sean was like, I don't have time for homophobia. And if you remember, there was something about some allegations that he was homophobic towards one of the castmates. And then this fool gonna actually say, while the show was receiving yet another one of its awards and everybody was standing there with a daggone trophy, he gonna get on the mic and say, I did not call XYZ, and then the F word. And I'm like, boy, you're dumb. And so everybody else was just like, So you absolutely did, or you intimated that you did. And so that's enough. And so, of course, Shonda booted him. But I think there were some other things, too, like maybe perhaps he was becoming a diva a little bit, or a divo. Maybe he was just doing too much. But anyway, I did not expect, following that spectacle that he made at, I think it was the Oscars or Emmys, at the Emmys, I did not expect to hear from him. I wasn't checking for him. I wasn't looking for him. I'm sure he played in some things, but I never saw them. Anyway, so when I saw him on P-Valley, I was like, okay, well, this is interesting that he would be on this show that is very unapologetically queer friendly, whose main character, for the most part, one of the mains where the center of the universe revolves around is Uncle Clifford, a trans woman, that he would play in this show. And then even though Isaiah Washington's character, Ty Dale Ruffin, that's a country name, Ty Dale. That's a country name. Anyway, even though Ty Dale and Uncle Clifford are adversaries, it's not homophobic. You don't get the sense that it's homophobic. You get the sense that Ty Dale is an opportunist and he capitalizes on the homophobia and the fear of other people, but that he himself don't really care. He too busy being an opportunist. Because as you see him move and shake, he using everybody. He going to the black barbershop, getting his hair did, but then also like stumping. You know what I mean? Like real opportunist. Couldn't have just a safe space in the world. Is always converting something. You see him shucking and jiving in front of white families that he turns around. They're clearly racist, but like thinly veiled. Racist white families that are these moneyed people. There's just one particular moneyed family that is on the periphery of all of the stories, but I don't really care. Anyway, but you see him sucking up to them, but then talking about them like they have tails before. Then he shucks and jives, and then he talks about them again after. And I'm like, oh, okay, so this is what it is. So he's just an opportunist, and he's going to try to exploit the situation to his best advantage, what come what may. But he's not problematic in doing so, and I thought that was refreshing. I also thought he dressed clean. I'm talking about clean. I said, of course, that's how he would dress. Why wouldn't he not dress super clean? Anyway, yeah, I was pleased with his wardrobe because that feels like a man of his age and stature in the South would dress like that. Shoot, you don't even have to be in the South. If you a black man of a certain age, and you in the political limelight, or you have some sort of power and influence at any point, there's a way that you dress. And because your suit, for all intents and purposes, is a part of this image. It's your armor. And so the way that they dressed him, I think, was appropriate. I will say this, the costuming of Uncle Clifford, I'm happy with for the most part, because it doesn't, it feels like Auntie. Let's be for real. Uncle Clifford dresses like Auntie, like cool Auntie, and then gets a little risque at times. But for the most part, Uncle Clifford dresses like cool Auntie, which I'm fine with, because I don't know that I'm cool Auntie, but I am Auntie at this point. I'm not long for my 30s anymore. So I think when I step into my 40s, I'm in the auntie phase now, my little niece. That's all right. I already got my little matching sets and everything. I'm ready to do this. Anyhow, but I digress. Yeah, that's all I want to talk about for the cast. Yep, that's all I care about. Anyway, all right, but let's go to some of the, so the critics' response. Always got to kind of bring that one in there. 7.1 out of 10 IMDb users enjoy this show. 95% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, but let's dig into it. The critics, and of course it would take a minute to load. Because duh. So, oh, here we go. 94, okay. The audience score, the average tomato meter score, which is the critic score, is 95%. The average audience score is 94%. So for all intents and purposes, this is a very highly rated. It's not certified fresh, and I don't know why it's not certified fresh, because after two episodes and it's still above the 90% threshold, like it's certified fresh for me. Anyway, The Pink is a popular, so here's what are the score details? Hold on, let me give you the score details. Why aren't you telling me what I want to know? Okay, season one critics consensus. Season one is certified fresh. Ooh, that's interesting. Season one is certified fresh. Oh, by the way, there's only 8 episodes in season one. I think there are 10 episodes in season two because there's a part one and part two to the last episode. So part one is really episode 9 and part two is episode 10. And they're like movie length, like an hour plus. But anyway, season one is certified fresh, and the critic's consensus is a stunning lyrical piece of neon noir. P-Valley explores the unseen lives of strippers in Mississippi through Katori Hall's singular gaze, celebrating the beauty of the craft without sugarcoating the challenges. And I do appreciate that. And I'm not really seeing a critic's consensus of season two, and I don't know why that is. Why don't I have a critic's consensus of season two? Huh. Anyway, well, hold on, bam. So season two, okay, now we've come to it. Season one was 100%, season two is not. The tomato meter score for the critics rating was 90% and the audience score was 99%. The critics rating is with 10 people reporting out, so I'm expecting some more, audience score comes from 1,706 reviewers. So I don't know about that, but what's the consensus here? Oh, so you just not gonna give me what I want, huh? Okay. I don't know why the critics, I don't know what the critics' consensus is. Oh, there is no consensus yet. Because I think it's still early days. Okay. So we'll leave it there. So 95 feels okay, but I think for it to be 90 only with only 10 reviewers, with only 10 critics reviewers, certified critics reviewing the show, I'm wondering if it'll go up, that 90 will be turn into a 95. I will tell you now, season one felt pretty perfect, nearly perfect in terms of this has never been done before. This story is the same as Moulin Rouge in a lot of ways. And in terms of going behind the curtain to see what's happening, the best little whorehouse in Texas. Do you know what I mean? Like going behind the curtain to see what's going on in the lives of these entertainers, these fantasy sellers, right? So that story isn't unique, but again, the approach is wholly new. And so I appreciate how more people would think, oh yeah, this is perfect because you have nothing to compare it to. But then when you come to season two, you have season two to compare to season one. And so was season two perfect? No. Were a lot of storylines advanced? Yes. I think the best storyline that was advanced is Uncle Clifford and Little Murder's storyline. I think Ernestine's storyline in terms of her history with the pink and what she experienced trying to keep it afloat, especially in the 80s, especially when her own daughter was coming into under the control of substance and just trying to get a handle of her own substance use issue and then finally succumbing to it. Like, I think there's a nod to that because certainly season two was shot during the middle of the pandemic, whereas season one was filmed right before the pandemic happened. It must've been filmed in 2019. But it was released, it was aired, of course, July 2020. So, you know, the second season is full of pandemic themes. And so I can appreciate how, you know, you remember the shows that were being filmed in 2020 that came out at the end of 2020, early 21. You know, it felt kind of dry. You know what I mean? They had to make references to the pandemic. And so there's a lot of social media references. The fact that in season two, they opened the pink as a drive-through experience. An outside drive-through experience. That is something that happened in real life with some of the clubs that were across the country, certainly happened here in Maryland. And then there was a moment where the Pank was reopened and an investigator, a health investigator, came in and had a bad experience and so shut it down. And then there was a moment where there was a throwback to a TV interview, and everybody talked about it, where these two women were being interviewed by a newscaster, and one of the women says, this is upsetting me and my homegirl. There's a nod to that. So there were social media references and real life depictions ripped from the headlines and put into the show. And so maybe that was a little too on the nose, perhaps for some critics. There are also some giant leaps that are taken in the story of Keyshawn. I will say that at the end of season one, what we know about Keyshawn is that she finds her footing despite being connected, married to this, her abuser in Derek. And we get the sense that she might be able to escape. She might be able to escape, but the way that season one ends, it's clear that she's still choosing. My bad, they're blending together. Season one, Derek is super controlling, super abusive, and his abuse spills out into the real world. And there's a moment where there's a will they, won't they, the will they, won't they that Diamond and Keyshawn are experiencing comes to an end when Keyshawn does something pretty much unforgivable to Diamond. And it sets everybody in a tizzy in season, at the end of season one, it's like, okay, bet. Season two, it's bump Keyshawn. We don't know her. Uncle Clifford is like, that name, that's a no-go. You don't say that name here in the paint no more. You don't say it here anymore. And again, there's the pink is a family. It's a family now. It's well established that it's been a family. And so, you know, we start the season off, season two, with Keyshawn really kind of spreading her wings with Lil Murda, who's also spreading his wings. And there's a huge arc in the middle of season two. And then at the end of season two, both Keyshawn and Lil Murda have some decisions to make. Unfortunately, the decisions that both of them make have some pretty high consequences. Consequences that we'll see in season three if they are up to facing. And I'll leave that there. What I will say before I move on, because it's getting late. What I will say before we move on is season one, we see Keyshawn kind of come out of her shell a little bit. Season two, we learn why she was put in her shell and why it's been so hard for her to get out. And also why it's been so hard for her to believe in her own self. And it has a lot to do with her family experience. And Derek's timing of coming in, which typically happens. That's what abusers constantly love bomb you in the beginning, give you this affection, and finds the way to finds your weakness and manipulates it, massages your ego, builds you up. And as soon as when they have you firmly in their grasp, they become their true selves, their true controlling selves. And so we see how the genesis of Derek and Keyshawn's relationship, and I don't know if y'all get, but I certainly got why Keyshawn was there. And there's a moment, anyway, at the end of season two, she makes a decision that I don't know that she's ready to live up to the, I don't know that she's ready to face the consequences of that decision. And it has a lot to do, the decision that she made is, she made it because she didn't do something she should have done back in season one, right? And so we'll learn more about that story later, but it's an interesting one. The only thing that I'll say about Lil Murda and his storyline is that his storyline, what we know is we progressively see more and more sides to what's his name? Lil Murda. So in the beginning, we see him as this thug that, you know, this hard little thug who's also a rapper. Hey, Lil, but this thug who is a rapper. By the way, this person has a, actually everybody in here, there's not a ton of homely people in here. Although I have to admit the dude that's the nephew to Ty Dale, he is not an attractive person. I don't know what about it. Maybe because he's so doggone skinny and I don't like that. It feels like he's too skinny and he probably can't even help it. That's literally his build, but it's just something bony about him that is not attractive to me. So anyway, but for the most part, everybody is decent to look at in the show. Lil Murda goes from being this rapper who kind of feels like a perpetrator, knows that he's committed some crimes before. You know he's committed some crimes, but he really just wants to be a part of his art. He's a poet at the end of the day. Even Uncle Clifford calls him a poet because that's what he is. That's what rapping is if you're true about your craft. If you're real about your craft, you are a poet. Anyway, so we see him go from this person who's wanting you to see the certain image of him to someone who wants to keep his sexuality a secret, to someone who maybe doesn't love the image that he's created for himself anymore and the expectation that that requires to uphold it. And then you move to, now maybe I want to do this new thing and what the consequences of doing this new thing might mean. We also see Uncle Clifford going through arcs, but not huge swings. Uncle Clifford, her swings are more inward swings. Uncle Clifford is a force to be reckoned with and is a defender of the pink from the very beginning, right? From the very beginning, the pank. I'm gonna keep saying the pank. From the very beginning, because that's how Uncle Clifford says it. I don't know. Anyway, I'm getting distracted. Anyway, so Uncle Clifford is a defender of the pink, but he's also a defender of everybody who is a part of the family of the pink. The pink is his legacy. The pink is her legacy. The pink was passed down from Ernestine, who got it passed down from her family member, I think her father. And so it's essential for Uncle Clifford to keep this because it's her inheritance. And so, you don't really see a lot of swings. What you see is her getting smarter, more crafty. You always got the sense that Uncle Clifford was not conniving, but a calculating person. But she becomes more calculating thanks to the deviousness of what's old girl's name? Haley. So thanks to the deviousness of Haley, Uncle Clifford gets more calculating. And there's a calculation that Uncle Clifford makes at the end that is the right decision, but it also means instantly there are some pretty heavy consequences that almost put her right back at the beginning in terms of the future. Not necessarily the future. Well, actually, it almost puts her right back in the beginning of where she came from. And if you've watched season one, then you kind of, well, if you watch both of these seasons, then you know what I'm talking about. It feels like we're back to the beginning with the pink, with Uncle Clifford, but with a twist, right? Okay. So then we go to, I think I'm going to talk about the generational conversation last. We go to Haley, who is leaving a very terrible situation under the guise of a flood, of a huge hurricane slash flood that has decimated this Mississippi Valley, Mississippi community, and lots of Mississippi and Louisiana, which is a real life event, right? So the show starts on a real life event. We are introduced to the pink through her. She is leaving someplace in some part of the South and gets on a Greyhound bus after finding a suitcase that has money in it and a new ID. It clearly is not her this ID is another light-skinned woman, and she's assuming this person's identity, but it's clearly not her. We don't know what her name is when we first meet her. We know what she tells us her name is, and that should have been our first clue that her story is a sad one, and it's important to have compassion for her, but don't trust her. Because she gets off the Greyhound mid-trip, and it's at night, and they're at a gas station. She looks off into the distance as she sees pink lights glowing in the distance, pink neon lights glowing in the distance. And then she grabs her suitcase and begins walking towards those lights. Despite someone calling her, "Halt, come on back, the bus about to take off, girl. You don't know where you're going." She goes it anyway. Again, this is a woman that feels like she doesn't have much to lose. On the one hand, you're scared for her, but on the other hand, it's like, whoa, she's making choices. And again, from the very beginning, she's showing that she's not afraid to do some new stuff. Now, you get the sense that she's running because she's fleeing an abusive situation, but you don't know the details. And you don't know everything. And so you're wondering what the heck is happening. Like, is there some more to it? As she, you know, wraps her arms around the pink, we understand, yeah, there's a lot more to it. Was in the first episode, in the first season, what do we know? Yes, Haley Colton was abused. She was in an abusive relationship. In this abusive relationship, though, or outside of the abusive relationship, she also schemed. She was a scammer. And she scammed the wrong person, which happened to be the person that she was deeply connected with. And in the process of scamming this person, this man, she loses a child that is not her own child, but a child she grew very fond of. I mean, very fond of. And as a result of that, probably as a result of losing that child, something in her broke. The child unfortunately drowned in the high waters of the natural disaster that she was fleeing from, as she was fleeing from this abusive man. And something in her broke. And as a result, the actions that she makes throughout season one become clear because that thing broke in her and she has not gone to counseling to put her pieces back together and to mend what needs mending. Her approach to relationships is very flawed, and she has a very get them before they get me sort of mentality. And so there's something that is pretty fabulous that she does at the end of the show of season one, only because Uncle Clifford, Big A.O., and Diamond do something for her. She does a kind turn because they did something kind for her, which kind is a relative term if you've watched all of season one. But because she was in danger. Anyway, but in season two, she gets some hate in season one, and you understand where it's coming from, but you also still have compassion for her. Season two, all that compassion is gone. For me, all of it was gone. And the twists and turns that she takes us through is more like her stepping into her villainy. Again, that piece of her that is broken has not been mended. Now, in the end of season two, she steps into a new situation that we get the sense she might be on her way to mending that thing that was broken. I don't know. But the problem is, I don't know if it's in the healthiest way. It's probably not in the healthiest way, but she is on her way to mending what was broken. And in the process, she's also stuck it to people. I can't tell you what I want to tell you without spoiling it. I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen it. The final episode went off maybe a couple of weeks ago, but I still don't want to spoil it because you really should be watching this. It's a really, really great show. But yeah, let's just say she steps well into her villain arc. Like, she's in it. She's in it all the way. And something happens, because again, I told you, Haley is the reason why Uncle Clifford becomes more astute and more calculating. So that there's something that happens with them. And it, again, the center of this universe is the pink. And so it has everything to do with the pink. And Haley thought that a plan that she put in motion was going to come to fruition it didn't matter the cost. Unfortunately, the cost of that plan mattered a great deal to Uncle Clifford. And so Uncle Clifford did what she needed to do. But again, the consequences of both of their actions, will they be able to face them? Now, we know that Uncle Clifford is up to facing the challenge, because that's what we saw Uncle Clifford do in episode one, season one. Uncle Clifford faces challenges for the things that he loves and things that are worth fighting for. Shoulders back, eyes forward, straight back. Straight's fine, shoulders back, eyes forward. That's how Uncle Clifford deals with adversity, because that's how Ernestine taught him how to do, and even his mother taught him how to do. That's how you do it. And so that's what she, and I said him, I keep saying him and I mean her. Apologies. Let's move on. But that's how she was taught to deal with adversity. So Haley has taught herself how to deal with adversity. And in her mind, adversity is anything that's coming against what she wants, which means that sometimes getting what she wants comes at your expense. And so we see that all of season two, we see it slowly moving that way. And we find that she's super calculating and she almost outsmarts herself, almost. And then the last thing that I want to talk about before I finish, and this is the final reason why you really should be watching this, is the conversation between Patrice, Mercedes, and Terica. That intergenerational mother-daughter conversation. It starts with Patrice, who, young mother, not a super young mother, but a mother who's very flawed, who, when Mercedes was a teenager, put Mercedes in compromising situations so that they could survive. Because she herself put herself in compromising, Patrice put herself in compromising situations so that she and Mercedes could survive. There's also, as a result of all of this, there's a lot of animosity between the two of them. A lot of animosity. There feels like some competition, feels like jealousy, but what it really boils down to is just a broken relationship and not knowing how to connect. Not knowing how to connect in a way that is meaningful, not being able to, yeah, that's it in a nutshell. And then in Rebellion, Mercedes has Terica at a very young age, but is not in a place to care for her. And so now the feels like the abandonment issues that Mercedes had with Patricia have now been passed on and are being felt by Terica. And so it's this cycle. There's a huge conversation about cycles. We also see Mercedes in her adulthood. She is 30. She is in what is considered in the exotic dancing world an older stripper, dancer. And you see her mother, who is now an ultra religious person, look down on her. And at first, I will say this, we see a journey with Patricia. You don't always love the journey. And I don't know that the end of her journey is super satisfying, but it is a change. It is growth. It is something different. She's not stagnant. You can't take that away from her, that she's moving and evolving. You move to Mercedes, and is there a lot of movement? Is there a lot of growth? I think so. I think she's reprioritizing what's important to her, and that she's stopped she's realized in her quest to not be like Patrice, she has in many ways become Patrice in a lot of different ways, just her very own version of Patrice. And so we see season one, we see this arc where she's trying to hold on to this title of being the best dancer in the pink to finding her footing. And for a minute she escapes and then she comes back because something happens to her. And you feel sorry for her because you know she has dreams. It's just there's some things that she needs to prioritize in order for her to be able to achieve what she wants to achieve. She's got to mend some relationships, it's clear, because she can't go it alone. She needs support. She needs to understand what it's like to love herself first and then to build genuine relationships with other people. And then to be a mother to her daughter, Terica. She wants Terica, but she doesn't know how to be a mother to Terica. And so what we see in Mercedes' growth is a lot. We see her move and change in a big way towards the end, which to me is very satisfying. And then we see Terica, who is a teenager. And you don't see a whole lot of growth in Terica. You see a child. You see a teen who wants her mama, who is rebelling against the woman who is her caretaker, who also she cares deeply for, and the push and pull between trying to figure out who she should have allegiance to and what that might mean. She makes a very big decision. There's a very interesting conversation about reproductive rights that revolves around Terica, that I feel like is kind of handled a little clumsily, but it's still a conversation that needed to be had. And so at the end of season two, we don't get resolution with the three of them. We don't. What we get is an understanding that there's still more work to be done, but that the three of them are willing to do that work. What that will look like in season three, we don't know. But what we do know is that they are committed in some capacity to do more. Now, will there be a lot of fighting and stuff? Probably, but and backstabbing? Absolutely. There was a point where Patrice and Mercedes were fighting in season one. So, come on. But anyway, so that is a storyline that I really do look forward to. And then, yeah, Uncle Clifford and Lil Murda. I'm just curious to see where that goes, because what I don't want, again, I won't stand for trauma for trauma's sake. Even the violence against Keyshawn, it felt like that there was a purpose, but I want. I still need them to be careful, because I want the stories to be real. And so far we're getting the real from Katori. I want them to keep getting the real from Katori, because the way that this ended was pitiful for Keyshawn. I wonder what season three holds, because I need them to be careful, because there is this thing that TV shows love to do, which is to perpetually make a person into a victim. And I don't know that that's real life. And not that you watch shows for real life, but if you want scenarios that seem real, then you got to do better than you got to come with it in season three, because this is also still very much a dramatization of real life. So you got to give me something to hope for, okay, with Keyshawn, and I'm expecting that. Anyway, yeah, the reason I binge watched season one and season two is because it was good storytelling. Katori did her thing on this. It was good storytelling. Lots to look for. There's even a conversation between two males, Lil Murda and his friend Thaddeus, who, let's be for real, if they were both open about their sexuality, they would have been a couple. They were a couple to themselves. Thaddeus did a lot of sacrificing, despite the fact that he was a broken person. Some very dark things happened to Thaddeus. Thaddeus sacrificed a lot for Lil Murda, and I don't get the sense that Lil Murda was always appreciative of that sacrifice in a way that was meaningful to Thaddeus, something very big, Thaddeus has a big storyline that kind of catapults Lil Murda into renewing his mind on how he approaches his life. But that story was pretty interesting and also heartbreaking, because both of them couldn't be who they were, but then also both of them were living with trauma, Thaddeus especially, that he really needed to see somebody about. But again, when you are living in this space where you're talked about for not projecting strong cis-hetero male, this strong cis-hetero male image, you are seen as weak. You are seen as someone that could be messed with. That storyline hurt my feelings, like, pretty deeply, actually. I appreciate how they handled it. I appreciate Lil Murda's response to it. But something about that storyline with Thaddeus hurt me real bad. And it was beautifully handled, too. Mm-hmm. I want more of that. I want not the trauma. I don't want trauma. I want real stories. If trauma is a part of it, handle it delicately and then move on. But I want more stories, because I want shows that really do make my heart ache a little bit. You get into the story, and I got into P-Valley. I got into some of these storylines. Not all of them were the greatest. And again, I started out, my heart hurt for Haley bad in the beginning. And now it didn't at all. I didn't shed a tear at the end. And she's going to be around in season 3, but I love stuff like that. I love it. I love it. It's been rare for a show to make me really deeply feel for characters. Game of Thrones and even House of the Dragons, it's given me the feels, but not like P-Valley. Not like P-Valley. I'm vested in these stories. Woo boy. Anyway, well, that's the show. I don't want to keep talking because I could really start spoiling big time. And I don't want to do that, because you really should watch this show. It's real, real good. Find a way to watch it. I don't know if it's been renewed for season 3. Like I said, the second season just ended a couple of weeks ago. I have no fear. There's no reason for it not to be renewed. There's still so many stories to listen to. There's still so many conversations to be had in this show. I only wish they would. I pray that it continues to excel and to keep topping itself, but not in a being fantastic way, but just more great stories and more twists and more chapters for some of the stories we're following, like the Terica Mercedes Patrice conversation and the Lil Murda Uncle Clifford conversation. I could care less if I ever hear from Haley Colton again, but you know, we're gonna. There's some other things happening in there, but you know, like Roulette, I don't like that child. I do not like that child. Something's gonna happen to homegirl. Her evil ways are gonna catch up to her. And actually, maybe I do want to see that, because my goodness, the way that she treated Whisper at the end. And Whisper, I actually like Whisper's character, but I feel like Whisper is playing it with danger while being with Roulette, and something's going to happen. That relationship's going to come to a head. Probably in season 3, that relationship's going to come to a head. And Whisper better watch out. But I have a feeling that Whisper can handle her own against Roulette. It's Roulette who is coupled with Duffy, who used to be with Gidget, and Gidget's gone from the storyline. But Duffy, you want me to believe that Duffy and Gidget, or Duffy and Roulette are supposed to be like the new Romeo and Juliet sort of couple? I don't know. He's a drug dealer and she is, for all intents and purposes, a skin peddler. And she's trying to make it seem as if she's empowering folks, but she got over on Whisper. So anyway, I'm looking forward to seeing what that storyline happens, because it's gonna come to a head, that relationship between Roulette and Whisper. Anyway, All right. Oh, shoot, I forgot. Something happens with Diamond. At the end, I forgot something happens with Diamond, and I got to see. Yes, I have to see season 3 because I got to know what happened to Diamond. Anyway, Diamond better be okay. Oh, they, I don't like it. Oh, my goodness. That's another thing. That scene at the end with Diamond. Oh, my goodness. At the end of episode 10, season 2 with Diamond. Oh, my goodness. It was great. Anyway, that's it. I can't talk no more. I'm going to start spoiling. I can't help it because it's so good. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourself. Do what you got to do to stay well, stay healthy. Take a break. Or your break is over. Get your work done. Whatever you need to do right now, I hope you get that motivation to get it done. Take care of yourself. Be kind to yourself, please. You're the only you we got. So take care of yourself. Be kind to yourself. And get some sleep. And drink some water. All right? Okay. And thanks for sharing the show with anybody that you think might dig it. This episode with anybody that you think might dig it. And giving the show a favorable rating, 4 or 5 stars or better. Doing that will help spread the reach of the show. And keep me doing this thing that is a hobby of mine. So I appreciate you in advance. All right. That's it for the show. Until next time.